Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. I'm Phil Bauermaster. Welcome to this program that explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. With me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm also fantastic. I suppose even super fantastic. Things are going pretty good. So
I should explain. I varied the intro there a little bit because I've gotten so used to doing the intros to the two archive shows where I go straight into giving my name that I almost threw myself off a little bit. Almost did, but yeah.
Yeah, you do that twice as often as the live show. So you have the Monday night show and the Saturday night show where basically it's a rerun, except you do the intro. So
yeah, well, and in fact, now we're doing new content on Saturday nights with the World Transformed 1.5. I'm doing they're much shorter monologue shows, and I'm talking just almost stream of consciousness about what kinds of things we did cover in the World Transformed 1, and that will therefore we need to get to in the World Transformed 2. So I'm kind of bridging the gap between the two shows, but I don't do it live. It is pre-recorded, although it is fresh content. So everyone, be sure and tune into that. You don't miss that. You know, new Phil, right? That's
excellent.
Always exciting. So we've got a terrific show lined up this evening. Before we jump into it, anything interesting going on that either of us need to share?
Well, I guess we have an interesting week designation this week. This is the you told me during the just before the show, Phil. What is this week exactly again? I might say it wrong.
Well, I would have said it wrong, too, because I would have called it National Telecommuting Week, and in fact, it's designated as National Telework Week. So I don't know why they use that term. I mean, I'm not familiar with that. Maybe it's me. What's the term you're familiar with, Stephen? Would you say telework or telecommuting?
Telecommuting, absolutely. I've never even heard the term telework.
Yeah, that's a new one for me. Chat room, chime in on this. If you know the phrase, if you know the word telework, you know, we want to get a consensus here that we're right and whoever named this week is wrong. But it's interesting. It means the same thing, and we're talking about people working from remote locations. So this is a week commemorating those who do that, and also for environmental and business savings reasons, encouraging people to give it a try, those who haven't done so, to give it a try. Now, there are really good advantages from a business standpoint to doing it. There are also downsides to telecommuting. It depends on the industry that you're in. It depends on the dynamics of the particular organization that you work for. And it depends a lot on the job you do and how well motivated you are in one environment versus the other. One of the things that is always raised about it, as an argument against telecommuting is that people will be at home. They're going to be very distracted. Their TV is there. Their pets are there. Their children might be there. There's all these stimulating influences that might distract them from work. Rather than getting the job done, they'll be sucked away by all those. That's not been my experience working at home. Definitely there are some distractions at home, but I find that there are five times as many distractions at the office. You know, you sit down to do something, somebody comes by and they want to talk about something that's important to them, not terribly relevant to what you want to do, right? That sort of thing. You know, the phone is ringing. There's people want to talk about the football game or the baseball game or or you know, whatever the news is. So there's a lot of give and take between those two, kind of the upside and the downside of it. But it occurred to me that for our theme this evening, which is better living through gadgets, this is actually a great example of a major lifestyle choice that has been enabled largely through technology. I think the prevalence of telecommuting is something that's really an artifact of the digital age. There has been telecommuting for a long time, but it's really hit its own. It's really come into its own due to the fact that people work largely in information and the fact that we've got laptops with Wi-Fi connections, we've got smartphones, we've got iPads, we've got all these various ways of getting online and being online and staying connected. And if your job is just dealing with information, then it's pretty easy to have access to that information and to work with that information, irrespective of where you happen to be at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, there's so many jobs that you couldn't do remotely. I'm thinking plumber, a dairy farmer, there's just some things you just got to.
Yes, the cows are where they are. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Obstetrician, you're going to need to actually be there, especially knowledge-based work, you can be anywhere in the world and do a lot of it. You've done a lot of telecommuting, probably a whole lot more than I have, Phil. You ever get, hungry for a adult company that you don't have at the house? What's that experience like? Because I've done some.
That is the one drawback to if you're just plain working from home and it's just you isolated. I mean, it's not like you're not talking to people. You're on conference calls with them. You speak to them on the phone. You're emailing. You're chatting. All of those kinds of things. And so it's not like you're completely isolated. But there is something to be said for actual face-to-face contact with other people, to actually be in the same presence with them. Not only from a personal standpoint, but also from a productivity standpoint. There are a lot of things that it's just much easier to do if you're sitting face-to-face. Training, I've found, although technology enables lots of different ways of delivering training, I think it's a lot more effective if you're in the same room with people and you can read their body language, you get the facial cues, you get all kinds of immediate feedback that sometimes doesn't come through even if you're doing video telepresence or using one of those technologies. So, yeah, there definitely is, I think, a personal and a productivity expense involved in that, although there's tremendous savings for companies that do it. You can save, according to this research at the Telework Research Network, maybe they're the ones who named it National Telework Week because that's the name of their group. I'm reading here, it says, shows companies can save over $6,500 annually per once-a-week teleworker. And the research projects that if the 41 million Americans with telework-compatible jobs work from home just one day this week, U.S. savings could total $772 million. Not bad. Pretty good money. So that's the trade-off. It's a certain amount of productivity lost, but a certain amount of money saved. So I think it's one of those things that has to be looked at very carefully by individuals and by organizations if they're deciding to implement it. But it's great that the choice exists, and it's great that that people are able to do that. Stephen, you and I were talking before the show started how digital technology, one of the really interesting things that it has done for us, it has in some ways re-enabled things that used to be done from home. Actually, work is a good example of that. Most people's jobs used to be sited at their homes before the Industrial Revolution. Schooling, which was often done in the house, in the home before the Industrial Revolution. And so you've got homeschooling, you've got home work, telecommuting, and home shopping we were talking about. And as we were discussing this, I realized that home shopping has been around for quite a bit longer than I originally thought.
Well, the Sears and Roebuck catalog, can we go back further than that?
I can't. As an example. But that was huge. I mean, it was especially important in rural America. As long as the post office could get to you, I mean, it was the Amazon of its day when you think about it. That Sears and Roebuck catalog was a way that people could get stuff they needed no matter where they were. Now, they didn't have Prime, right? And you couldn't get stuff next day or any of that kind of stuff. But the notion of home shopping has been around for a long time, long before the home shopping network. I was thinking of it primarily as something that had come about in the digital age, and I think it's something that has been massively turbo-accelerated by Internet technology. But it's an impulse that people have had all along. I think there's a tendency for people to think anything they'd like to do, anything that they need to do, want to do, have to do, they just assume do it at home if they can. And we may all become major homebodies in the future as technology allows us to do that. I mean, you can, you know, once virtual reality becomes realistic enough, once it's truly implemented, people can take whole vacations at home. But all this is to say, this is technology enabling a major lifestyle change. So this is better living through now. Here's the question. The show is called Better Living Through Gadgets. So are we going to allow major infrastructure technology to count as gadgets too, or are we going to be pure and say what is a gadget? How would you define a gadget actually, Stephen?
Well, I would say that if it fits in my pocket, it's a gadget. I don't consider my laptop a gadget. You know, I would say that, you know, before the digital age, people use the word gadget, and, you know, it might refer to, I don't know, something mechanical even. But I think that pretty much nowadays when people say gadgets, they're thinking iPhones, you know. So that's how I would define it. I think that's the way people are used too.
So, and I think that's right. So the progression here then is for each of the improvements we're going to talk about, we'll talk about whether it's better living through technology and then whether it can be supported via a gadget. So we'll be true to our name. So beginning with this first one, telecommuting is supported very well by gadgets, as a matter of fact. I use my iPhone for work incessantly, and I actually made a list of all of the different places that I have worked from over the last, 6 months or so. And here's my list of different locales that I've worked from. My assigned office, a different office in another company location, a cube in that same location, my house, various airports, various airplanes, and I would note that airplanes are the only environment where I'm still consistently most of the time offline. It's the only place where I work that I'm offline. Hotel rooms, Starbucks, a hospital, and then, there's just a bunch of them, and I can't think of the specifics, but lots of other places that provide Wi-Fi. So, you know, it's like this, my job has been massively scattered across all of these different locations. When I say I telecommuter that I work from home, that's just, you know, that's just scratching the surface. I actually work from all kinds of locations, and it's largely enabled by two technologies, not counting the Wi-Fi itself. One is my laptop, which we're not going to call a gadget, and one is my iPhone, which I think by our definition very much is a gadget. So, yes, telecommuting, by our definition, is better living through gadgets. A gadget.
Yep. Absolutely. Okay. I would say one other thing is going to push us towards telecommuting, telework, whatever you want to call it. I would say if gas prices go up, that's going to push us more and more in that direction. I know it's been enabled by, by digital technology, but, if times get rough, I think that more people will work from home because it'll be cheaper than driving into work.
There you go. That's a good point. And in that instance, it's still the technology that enabled us to make that decision and save money on gas. Okay,
Absolutely.
So what's our next better living through gadgets example?
Well, let's talk real quick about the kid. in that video I posted back on Friday. You know, I don't know if that would his 3D printer would count as a gadget under our definition. It wouldn't fit in your pocket, but man, that kid. Wouldn't you like to have him as a presenter for your company? I mean, you know, it provided that you know that he's interested in something. He's, you know, he was just awesome, wasn't he? I mean, he absolutely floored that room with how fired up he was about the technology of 3D printing.
It's amazing. It's just so much fun to watch that. I'm sorry, I was just looking over the chat room. We've got a new definition here that I think we have to go with. Anything Inspector Gadget can use is a gadget, okay? So I totally agree with that. Inspector Gadget would love this 3D printer, right? Because actually he doesn't need it because he just seems to, everything morphs into something else. The man has got advanced nanotechnology at his disposal, clearly. But a machine that will just print out your glasses for you or your, you know, all of these different gizmos. There's another term we're going to have to define, I guess, at some point. All these different things that this – actually, that's why it's better with your gadgets. You can create gadgets with the 3D printer, come to think of it. All these different things that he's just able to produce that before you would have to go acquire someplace. That is just this fundamental change. I was talking about this on the World Transformed 1.5 on Saturday. It is a precursor to a fundamental change in our relationship with the material world, and that's what we talked about in the World Transformed, the original series. We now are moving towards an era where material goods are digitized in the way information has been digitized. And we see the tremendous – this is actually a great example to follow telecommuting, Stephen. This was the perfect one to follow that example because the sweeping change that we saw from everything always being completely place-dependent, location-dependent, to much of what goes on in the employment world, in the business world being independent of location, had to do with information being digitized. And the fact that the economy began to run on that and the fact that we were all accessing that information, that digitalization of information just exploded how the world works. It just completely changed how the world works. But that's small potatoes compared to what happens when we start digitizing matter. And this isn't digitized matter. I mean, this is dealing with matter, reforming, reshaping material goods using digital technology, but it's not the end game, which is going to be advanced molecular nanotechnology, which will allow us to produce just about anything as easily as we can currently copy and paste a large chunk of text. Right? That's you think how easy it is to go into Google Images, look for a picture of a Ferrari, and copy that JPEG and paste it here and then paste it there and paste it someplace else. We're talking about a future where it will be just about as easy to actually produce a real Ferrari. And then if you want another one, you hit paste again and you get another one. And if you want another one, you hit paste again and you get the third one. That's where this technology is going. And that will not only be a very different world, but that's bound to be better living through technology, I think. And the kids' excitement, I think, has largely to do with the fact that, you know, he's in control, right? Look what I made.
Right.
This is the thing all kids like to say. And this kid has made some really neat stuff.
Absolutely. You know, he's got, some whistles there, and he was geeking out over the fact that he could make, you know, all he has to do is size it up in his CAD program to make a huge whistle if he wants to make a – and I'm talking like the kind of whistle that your coach would wear around his neck, okay? And
right,
he could make one that's a whole lot bigger. It probably sounds differently. Or he could go a whole lot smaller. He could make them different colors, things like that. Now, what excites me, you know, I feel like we're still in the very, very early stages of this kind of 3D printing, fabbing technology. When they're able to incorporate electronics into the print, You know, you're not just laying down plastic, but you can also lay down silicon and metal within the plastic, and then, you know, create a digital gadget, you know, like an iPhone. You know, that to me is when it gets really, really cool. You know, and they've got these fabbing projects, Bill, where, you know, the RepRap, the whole purpose of that project is to try to figure out how to get a 3D printer to be able to print another 3D printer. And
right.
and it's interesting what they've been able to accomplish so far. They, you know, all the plastic parts, certainly it can print. But, you know, you still got to buy the circuit boards, and there's still metal parts in it and things like that. You got to go buy, and you put it all together, and you have a new 3D printer. But I think the day will come when you'll have a truly self-replicating machine where it will be able to print in full another 3D printer, you know, once you're able to print these, you know, electronics within it. And so that to me is when it gets really interesting and really cool. And we're not
there
yet.
There's two reasons why that's huge, I think. Two reasons why that's huge. One reason that that's huge is because if you can, if you've got a machine that can make that, if you've got a machine that can make a 3D printer, then there are very few other devices it could not make, right? I mean, once you've got circuitry and plastic, you know, you've got the metal and the silicon and the plastic all in various formulations, that is a huge number of different things you can make. So if it has the capacity to make another 3D printer, it has the capacity to make many, many more things than we're seeing in this video, and things that will work, right? I mean, things that, like you said, like an iPhone, things that will have the capacity to do incredible things. So it's huge when they get to that point, because that is a demonstration of tremendous capability in terms of replicating lots of different things. But probably more importantly, that's huge because that's where 3D printing goes viral.
Exactly.
If a 3D printer can produce a 3D printer, everybody gets one, right?
Exactly. You know, I get a 3D printer. You know, I print out a 3D printer for you, Phil, and mail it to you.
I'd like one of those, please.
Yeah, okay, there you go. Zip, you got one. And then, you know, you obviously print out 3D printers for your friends and family. But then you turn around and say, well, you know, that's cool. Everybody's got a 3D printer now. What would be some cool things I could make? And you look around your house and you realize, you know, other than maybe food, you know, there's precious little in your house that couldn't be made with a 3D printer, you know? And so you decide, well, I always wanted this, I always wanted that. You print those things out, and you know, I would imagine there would be you know, all kinds of the same sort of copyright issues and you know, trade secret issues that have been you know, the battle that has gone on with music and now with movies and other videos. Those battles will be replayed with physical items, you know.
Well, my Ferrari example earlier. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. When you're driving around in
Ferrari, would have a major problem with that example, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. You're driving around in your Fiaro. You say, no, this is not a Fiari. This is a Fiaro. So therefore, there's no problem. Well, they're probably going to have a problem with that. You know, if it looks exactly the same and drives exactly the same, they're probably not going to be happy with you having that. So. Yeah, I see these things. You know, there's going to be some shakeout in how this stuff works out, but it'll be an interesting time, no doubt.
Well, speaking of this, I saw a piece on the Freakonomics blog today that really caught my attention. The headline was this was Stephen Dubner. He's the journalist half of the Freakonomics team. Is it time to start talking about the future again, was the headline. And he's talking about the fact that while the economy's down and people are worried about the future because of that, we don't talk much about the future. The future is not something that we look to. And if people do have something to say about the future, they generally have something pretty bleak to say about the future. So that also tends to keep people from talking about it. But he had two stories that he particularly wanted to draw attention to that had a very non-bleak view of the future. One of them was in The Economist, and it was the headline was "Print Me a Stradivarius, the Manufacturing Technology That Will Change the World." And obviously, we're talking about 3D printing. We're talking about replication there. And the other was in Time magazine, and the story we've talked about, 2045, the year man becomes immortal, story about Ray Kurzweil. So it's cool that Freakonomics in the year, 2011 is pointing to two topics that we've been blogging about the speculators for the last 7 years. That's kind of cool. But it's also cool to see those two ideas really falling into mainstream discourse like that. We've heard rumblings around the singularity. Every now and then, Kurzweil gets some attention, 60 Minutes or something like that, and people pay attention to it for a few minutes. But I can't recall 3D printing getting a lot of mainstream press, and I think that story is about to really break and really enter into the popular consciousness. And I think that's very exciting. The fact that people are becoming aware of these possibilities is great, as long as they're getting a good view of them. And if they're talking about Kurzweil around the singularity, then they're getting a good view of that. And obviously, it sounds like The Economist was pretty darn optimistic on 3D printing. I should point out that in Dubner's article, he had a footnote that says, related to something you just said, Stephen, even food can be printed. And it's true. I have heard about these kind of specialty 3D printers that are just for making confections. You can make candy with them. You can make cakes. There's all kinds of interesting shapes and things you can do with them. I don't think there's going to be for a while, probably not until we get close to nanotechnology, a machine that produces both an iPhone and a three-course meal. You might have two.
Yeah, you're not going to be able, with the present 3D printing they do with food, you're not going to be on a low-carb diet. I think 90% of what's printed, I think, is icing. They can print different images on a cake and things like that. I think that's primarily what the type of printing they're talking about there. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, at this point. Yeah, but there's promise there too. I think at some point, particularly if we ever get bat meat, it seems like if we perfect that, then at some point after that, we'll be able to just print a steak. That'd be pretty awesome.
I think you've got to have the Star Trek replicator before you can print out a steak.
Not
going to
happen, really. maybe a hamburger steak. It seems to me like you just have hamburger in the printer nozzle, and you just you can lay that down. But anyway,
and I think we'll have hamburger steaks printed out way before we'll have actual steaks printed out. That'll be one of the test cases. I mean, that's almost the Turing test for the 3D replication of food. I think produce a steak, right? Give me a juicy hot, New York strip, right? Medium rare, right? Captain Picard, Earl Grey hot, that's nothing, right? We're talking about actually, although they did on the show, of course, get whole meals replicated like that. And therefore, we will too, because Star Trek is, of course, our future. But seriously, I think that what we're seeing here, and the reason this is all very exciting, is that these are the early precursors of technology that will eventually give us those capabilities, and that's really something to look forward to. Is that going to be better living through gadgets? Absolutely. Are they gadgets? Well, going by the Inspector Gadget definition, I'm going to say absolutely those are gadgets. So
awesome.
That's a good one too.
Yep,
all right,
yep.
So next I'd like to talk a little bit about the artificial leaf, which you have described as essential future tech. And I note that this story also came from The Economist. The Economist, I think they must read the speculators quite regularly. They seem to be they seem to be picking up on a lot of our kinds of topics here.
Well, I think they must have some singularity-aware writers now at The Economist because,
It's probably reading Next Big Future, is actually what they're probably reading. But they do seem to have turned a corner around truly engaging, accelerating change, and really talking about some of these kinds of scenarios that were not at all mainstream, or still aren't mainstream, but that were not never even talked about that long ago.
Well,
so let's talk about
think about it this way. I was just going to say, think about it this way, Phil. What if you had? Think about it this way. With The Economist, you're either going to be all bleak all the time, or you're going to talk about accelerating tech. I mean, what is the antidote to the hole that we have ourselves in? We're going to have to innovate our way out of it, it seems like. And perhaps you get tired of being bleak all the time over at The Economist, so they throw some of this in there. I think that may be part of the reason we're seeing them go this route more and more. So, yeah. But anyway,
I think they're going the right way to talk about these kinds of things, and because that is the right approach. We innovate our way to the next level. We solve today's problems with tomorrow's technology. That's the right way to do it. Now, talk to me about what an artificial leaf is and why the term difference engine would apply to it.
You're going to have to explain that difference engine term and why the difference engine would apply to the artificial leaf. But let me just tell you that artificial leaf is what we're doing is we're looking at a leaf on a tree and trying to determine how it is that leaf takes sunlight and turns it into fuel, not just to power the plant, but also to power the animals that eat the plant and us eventually. It's a pretty fantastic thing that's happening there. It's been happening for millions of years. And so And the thing is, we've not been able to match it. I mean, we consider ourselves clever. Well, we have not yet been able to reverse engineer exactly what is going on in the leaf. And so there's a lot of time has been spent on this project and problem, but it's been at least theoretically it's been worked on for about 30 years. And so.
Wow.
There's a lot of excitement now, finally, in this field that they may be, getting closer and that they understand a little better what is happening with chlorophyll and how it is that it's producing fuel. And the thought is this, if we can understand it, then we can build our own systems that use molecules like chlorophyll to take light and directly convert them into, say, hydrocarbons. We could engineer our own plant that would be basically watermelons, but instead of the melons full of water, we could have melons full of hydrocarbons. That's the sort of way you engineer your way out of a crisis, right? I mean, if you can do that, then peak oil begins to look like less and less of a problem. And you know what else looks like less of a problem? Global warming. Because even though you're still burning hydrocarbons, if you're making watermelons full of gasoline, it's a carbon neutral process because the plant would have to absorb carbon in order to make the hydrocarbon. So you don't need to
introduce any new carbon into the ecosystem in order to get the energy, which you currently do when you're pumping petroleum out of the ground or digging for coal or using any of the other carbon-rich fuel sources that we currently use.
A seriously awesome twofer there. We take care of two problems there, and the artificial leaf gets us there. And, the other thing, solar panels, we only get a certain amount of our electricity from it. There's part of the thing that this could do, if we're able to produce liquid fuel, or some sort of chemical fuel directly from sunlight, it solves a lot of the problems that we've dealt with solar power. And that is, what happens when it's night? How do we use solar power at night? how do we store it? Well, if we're creating energy sources like that, you use that energy source anytime you need it, even when the sun's not shining. And so it's a big deal, and they've been working on it. And there's a project, the Joint Center for Artificial Photosynthesis has gotten this huge grant, and they're working out of Pasadena in California at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. And they're pretty excited about some of the advances that they've had so far. They're getting closer.
It's really very exciting, and it seems to be right at the convergence of a lot of different possible technologies for how we might get energy. And we've talked about algae that might produce hydrocarbons. We've talked about genetic engineering that might lead to that sort of thing. But this is the most basic and fundamental way of producing energy on the planet. This is kind of what has led to everything else, right? I mean, plants started doing that, and the whole food chain is built on it. And so, sort of indirectly, then all subsequent use of energy is sort of, this was kind of the pilot light that got everything else going. So it's interesting to think that we might be going back to that. It's almost like capturing fire, right? This original magic that gave us energy and making incredible new use out of it. It's been the thing that has provided so much of what we do now anyway. And to think that we're going to actually get a handle on how it happens. I love the image of watermelons filled with gasoline. That's, do not insert a candle into one of those, right?
Exactly. Well, think of how much more efficient. I mean, think if we really could do that, think of how much more efficient that would be than trying to grow liquid fuel from corn or sugarcane or switchgrass or algae even. Once you've grown those crops, you still have a lot of refining left to do, a lot of work left to do in order
right.
to get fuel that you need. But, I mean, if you're literally able to, put a spigot on a melon and pour it into your gas tank, I kid a little bit. But, that's
yeah,
the goal,
that
get a lot
easy.
Closer to something that's very, very close to being able to be used straight out of the plant, If you could get that, a lot closer, they're talking maybe 10 times more efficient than, the current, maize crops, corn crops, the corn ethanol and things like that. If you're, basically without subsidies, no one would do corn ethanol. It just costs way a whole lot more than even $100 a barrel of petroleum. It's just it's just too expensive. You're not getting any positive energy out of it. You put more energy into getting it than you do out of it. But now we've got some political backing behind something that really is bad for a lot of reasons, including putting food into our gas tanks, which is hurting people around the world. So, yeah.
Not an awful lot of enthusiasm for corn-based ethanol these days. I mean, Al Gore has come out against it recently, I believe. So I think it should be on its last legs, I would think, considering the options that we have in place of it. Although once something gets subsidized from the government, I guess that's pretty hard to make it stop happening.
Yeah. It's on its last ears, we hope. Right. So.
It's on its last years, exactly. So the difference engine was actually the name of the article in The Economist that you had linked to in your story. And
yeah.
I thought it was really interesting that they used that term. We know when I hear the phrase difference engine, I think of Babbage, and I think of his original computer, which you referred to as a difference engine, basically a machine that you could put different inputs into it and perform and calculate the difference between the two.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I think the parallel here is they're talking about the catalysts that will split water into hydrogen and oxygen on the one hand, and then the others that will convert carbon dioxide and hydrogen into hydrocarbons on the other hand. That photosynthesis, by using these two catalysts, taking energy, those two catalysts, and that basic input, and producing something completely different, energy, is sort of like the Babbage computer. You put two inputs in and you get an answer out, right? You put water and sunlight in and you get gasoline out. You get hydrocarbons out. So it's kind of an interesting parallel between those two things. But again, here, as we were talking about earlier, now we're talking not just about information, but we're talking about doing it with physical matter. So once again, this speaks to our whole eventual change in relationship between ourselves and the material world.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, is it a gadget?
Cool. Yeah. Yeah, it will be. Yeah. I doubt that we will, personally be walking around with artificial leaves. I think that's probably going to be something that will still be used within, within refineries, factories, things like that, in commercial settings. But we'll sure all benefit from that gadget, if you choose to call it that. It's going to be that could be a very big deal.
Absolutely. And we should note, this is true nanotechnology. This is the original nanotechnology, a molecular technology that already existed in nature that we're learning to get a better handle on. So I'm going to agree that it's definitely better living, and I think it's from a gadget. So we've talked a lot about technologies changing the world. Now let's get to the headline. The chat room couldn't wait. They've already discussed Jeopardy and Watson, but let's talk about it. Steven, you put a post up earlier today. Give us an update on what's happening with the whole Watson on Jeopardy situation.
Well, Watson yesterday, it was a tie after the first day. I believe that was Monday, right? It was Watson versus the two best human players on Jeopardy, Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter, were playing.
I wonder if just for guests or people who don't listen to us all the time, who don't read the website, should we say what this is all about?
Do we define singularity or what? What are you saying?
Actually, I was just going to say Watson is a computer program that's playing Jeopardy right now. It's on the TV show Jeopardy, competing against human beings. Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. For anyone who doesn't know, Watson is a computer playing Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter on Jeopardy. Now, the thought of computers playing games, that's not mind blowing, really, is it? I mean, we play against machines all the time. There's some video games I play on my laptop against the computer more often than against other human players elsewhere. And even our iPhones have games on them. But and of course, Deep Blue, back in 1997, beat the world chess champion. So we're even used to the idea of maybe computers playing better at some games than humans. But it's a little bit mind-blowing that Watson could be beating the best human players of Jeopardy, because what you do on Jeopardy is a show where they ask, they give you the answer and they ask you to provide the question about general knowledge. You have and even things like puns, give me Phil Barack's Peruvian pack animal, under the category of presidential rhymes. Well, Barack's Peruvian pack animal under presidential rhymes.
What is an Obama llama, please?
There you go, Obama llama. Well,
all
Watson
right.
Got that.
I'll take great women of the 17th century for 500, Alex, please.
There you go. What blew my mind is Watson, I figure in that category the humans are going to walk away with it, right? I mean, you're having to not just, come up with the fact that you're talking about Obama when you say Barack, and also, llama when you're referring to Peruvian pack animal, but you're looking for rhymes, okay? So the computer had to understand what a rhyme was. They had to understand, it had to be able to place obviously the president's name and the and what a Peruvian pack animal might be, and then put it together faster than a human player, and then throw it out there in the form of a question. So I mean, to me that was it's just absolutely incredible what they're able to do. So Watson won
that last on a couple of levels there, because think about what's happening. Obviously, to use your earlier example, when a computer beats a human being in chess, there is highly sophisticated mathematical processing going on. The computer is approaching that as a math problem, and it's doing something remarkable by beating like the world champion, the best chess player in the world. In this context, from the example you just gave, there's probably hundreds of things going on, but two things going on that immediately occur to me when you give that example. The first one is there is some parsing of language that is much more sophisticated than anything we've seen from computers before. I'm not going to say that the computer understands the meaning of the words, because I'm not sure I even know what that means, okay, to say that a computer might understand the meaning of the word. But that computer is parsing, it's parsing those meanings much more subtly, to a much more fine degree than anything we've ever seen before. It has to be to put those kinds of relationships together. Then, to handle a totally off-the-wall concept like the ability to rhyme. You know, you're combining that is something you can find from a lookup table, for sure, but you have to understand that, right? And so now you're looking for rhymes that match a particular meaning. That's an extremely sophisticated and complicated set of processes that computer's going through as fast as, or faster than, it sounds like, than the human beings are able to. Now, I have one question about how this works. Is the computer hearing the questions and responding to Trebek's voice? Is it reading them? Are they feeding them in? How does that work exactly?
The computer is listening to Trebek and answering in a human voice. Yeah.
Wow.
That's, you know, it's just...
That's pretty amazing right there. You know, I mean, just that.
Yeah.
If nothing else, that it's just picking up on all that. And I commented...
You know, other subtle things that it's doing that may not be quite as impressive, but still pretty impressive, is things like other strategy within the Jeopardy game is, you know, there were points at which it was a little bit behind, and so it would bet more money on a daily double to catch back up. And then there were other times when it was way out in the lead, and it'd have a good answer, but it only bet a little bit of money on it, because you know if you're already walking away with the game, there's no point in betting all your money on something. Okay, it understood the game well enough to play that, play those angles as well. So it's just a remarkable thing. So, of course, my question was, and what I asked in my blog post is, okay, all right, did the singularity just happen in front of Alex Trebek right there on his Jeopardy game show? And I basically kind of hedged a little bit and said that something absolutely amazing has happened here on the show, and it's going to be very, very important, but it's not quite the singularity. And I mean, what do you think, Phil? I mean, do you see how important is this, and does it amount to a singularity?
I don't think it's the singularity. I actually, my flippant response to you was that no, of course not. You know, now that we know a computer can win at Jeopardy, that means that winning at Jeopardy doesn't require real intelligence. And that quip, based on the fact that as soon as a computer could beat a human being in chess, suddenly chess didn't require real intelligence the way some more sophisticated activities do. So that's what the skeptics will tell you. They will tell you that not only is this not the singularity, it's not even all that significant of an occurrence, because I think one of the commenters said, well, they're just using lookup tables. And another one said, the lookup table person, I think, said something to the effect of, it's just what Google does. And I really don't think this is exactly what Google does, for one thing. But one of the other commenters said, it just, it's faster on the draw. So what? A computer can push a button faster than a human being. I'm like, okay, you need to understand that if he could own, if it, he, however, whatever pronoun is appropriate for Watson, I'm going to say he, if he could only press the button faster than the other two opponents, he would lose. Because the impressive thing is, it's not that he presses the button faster, it's that he presses the button faster and then when called upon, has the correct answer, okay? You see, it's that,
you know,
you're missing the little thing here, okay? The, like the amazing, he's figuring out answers to questions part, which is absolutely astounding. I mean, it gives us
Learned that, Phil. Phil, we learned how important it was to actually have the right, correct answer when we saw how fast Sean Connery could press the button on Saturday Night Live. You know, I mean, he was buzzing in. your brother.
Friday. If I don't do it, you put one up on Friday. We'll have to do that for our Friday video. That was a singularity. Will Ferrell is.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you made your flippant response, you know, we know that it's not the singularity. We know it's not true intelligence because a computer can do it. I kind of responded to that by posting Kurzweil's cartoon out of The Singularity Is Near. Did you notice that the human race cartoon?
Yeah, that's great.
Well, it shows this guy riding out, you know, all these things that only humans can do, and then of course he's having to, you know, to scratch, you know, a big old X through the thing when he realizes, oh, computers can do that now. And on the floor with X's on stuff is like only humans can understand continuous speech. You know, only humans can improvise jazz. Only humans can play chess, et cetera, et cetera. On the wall, back when this, you know, when The Singularity Is Near came out in 2005, okay, on the wall, things that still that in 2005 only humans could do, there were a couple of things now that need to be on the floor with X's on them. And that's only since 2005. Did you see those?
I'm looking at it right now. Only humans can drive cars.
X on it and be on the floor now. Okay.
That's right.
You see another thing on the wall there that needs to be on the floor again.
Well, that'll be our final gadget, right? Only a human can translate speech.
That's right. That's right. That's part of what Watson had to do. You know, was to be able to parse speech. And of course, we got Google Translate that now you can speak into and it'll translate into another language. So it's on your iPhone and other devices like that. So, yep, it's the human race. It's getting harder and harder to stay ahead of these machines, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm looking at the cartoon. What is he writing there? Only humans
can write a book about computers.
Oh.
I imagine that's
Kurzweil sitting there writing those. He wouldn't write those.
I think that's Kurzweil there writing that there. So he's that's
funny.
That.
Yeah, he's giving himself the out there. Only he could have done that. But we will see all of those items on the floor with big X's through them, and it's happening quite fast. That is amazing. That two of those are prominent. One of them that we're actually had on the docket to talk about tonight, the translation of speech, which definitely is a gadget. But you know, it's interesting to swing it back to Watson for a moment and talk about better living through gadgets. Here's what we can predict from this happening this week. The capability to I'm not going to say understand, but to parse meaning in language that Watson is displaying in real time, spoken language, is technology that we're going to be interacting with ourselves in the very near future. 5-10 years from now, what Watson is doing will be available on your whatever the iPhone of that era will be, whatever your small device that you carry around with you that is your link into this by then much vaster digital world. And things like translating speech in real time will be, it will be something that you take for granted, that the interface will be able to pick up shades of meaning, will be able to translate figures of speech, will be able to understand when you're making a little pun or making a little rhyme. the way you would expect a human being to parse those things when you're talking to them. That is a fundamental change in how we respond to, or excuse me, how we interact with machines. And that is very close to the singularity. So getting back to your original question, did the singularity happen? No, but this is a signpost, a major signpost on the way, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Watson, I think the technology behind Watson will soon be available to all of us. You know, I mean, think of how awesome it will be to basically have an MD at your disposal 24 hours a day. Just pull out, you know, man, something's going on with me. You get on your iPhone and you're able to quickly determine what the problem is. You know, it can be diagnosed by a Dr. Watson. So there you go.
Exactly. Well, we talked today, and it's true. I mean, we're sincere when we say this about how we can't live without these gadgets. But in that world, it's going to be a lot closer to the truth. I mean, that we will be dependent on them because of that level of sophistication of interaction in a way that even today, even knowing that that's coming, it's really hard for us to imagine how tightly integrated we're going to be with them because of the value that they can bring. Things like, you know, there's a doctor, I got a headache, what's going on, right? And having that device you carry with you actually be able to give good information and be able to help you in a way that currently you would actually have to go visit a doctor in order to get that. A big change coming.
Absolutely.
And I'd say better living through gadgets. Absolutely. All right, so we've zipped through those. We probably could have done another 90 minutes on top of this if we had any one of these probably would have been worth an entire show, actually. But fun talking about this stuff. I guess nothing left to do but say, what's the music this evening?
The song is Blackout in Wonderland by Jericho.
Blackout in Wonderland. And is this Alice in Wonderland, or?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so Jericho singing Blackout in Wonderland. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. And actually, thank you for providing all of our topics this week. I've been a little slow on the Speculous blog. I promise to be catching up here in the near future. We'll be back on Saturday evening with a brand new World Transformed 1.5 short monologue edition. We'll have an archive show on Monday, and we'll be back on live again next week. Hope you can join us for all of our upcoming programs. And until next time, live to see it.